Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining me. I've got a great interview to present to you today. We're going to be speaking with writer Duncan Mensch, who has written a fascinating essay in County Highway and some other things, which we're going to talk about. But first, let me just say, last week was guest hosted by Dan Morfitt, and I want to say thank you to Dan for doing such a great job with the show. Dan spoke with his guest, John Ashbrook, about AI and the movies. If you want to go back and listen to that, you can find it at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And what was interesting is, which I found a little funny, is that in the conversation, somehow they touched on Soylent Green, which is not that surprising. They were talking about movies and tech dystopia. And that was the same beat that Dan and I hit in our conversation when Dan was on the show with me back in April 2025. And so there have been a couple of instances of Soylent Green coming up on Tectonic. And the joke is, we're not going to give away the spoiler because probably everybody already knows it. But that's the joke anyway. And then, so that was sort of on my mind. And then I saw this essay by Duncan Mensch in County Highway, and it's called Soylent Screens. Wow. There it is again. And I started reading this essay, and as I said, really insightful and provocative. And it's in the July-August 2025 issue of County Highway. And I thought, let's speak with Duncan Mensch about these ideas. So I just want to say, one of my favorite authors who I have really drawn inspiration from in putting together Tectonic over the years is a French author and philosopher named Jacques Ellul. E-L-L-U-L is how you spell his last name, Ellul. And Jacques Ellul, I've read more than just this, but his masterpiece was this book called The Technological Society. He wrote it in 1954 in French, and then it came out in English in 1964. And I give you those dates to give you a sense of how long ago these ideas were current. And Ellul was warning the world about the spread of technology, that it was this inexorable, unstoppable force that was going to take over everything. And that was in the 60s, and we're seeing how this has played out. And Duncan and I are going to talk more about Ellul's ideas and how they have inspired Duncan's own thinking. The thing is, though, that it leads to somewhat grim conclusions about the future of our society if it really is this unstoppable force. And so it's nice that Duncan's twist is that he has a proposal for where we can go from here. There is a hopeful idea that he is advocating, and it's this idea called producerism, which he's going to talk about. So this interview we're about to hear is, let's say, about half is going over some of the ideas of Ellul and other authors who have given us some food for thought, but rather grim and potentially depressing thoughts. And then the other half gets into Duncan's idea of producerism, which, as I say, is a more hopeful vision of the future. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Duncan Mensch here on Tectonic. Duncan Mensch, welcome to Tectonic.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you on the show. You describe yourself as a punk philosopher and recovering academic. You've taught at four different American universities across multiple disciplines, and you write for various media outlets, including the one that caught my eye most recently, County Highway. This is an unusual publication. Before we get to your writing there, how would you describe County Highway to someone who hasn't heard of it?
Well, I mean, I would describe it as the most rebellious publication you're going to find, because I mean, every aspect of it is rebellious. It's you know, literally print only, or I mean, you can now get an online subscription, although it's practically discouraged. But I mean, every single aspect of its approach is basically kind of a heterodox, you know, or, you know, an FU if you want to mainstream approaches politically. The fiction also, not just in terms of the literary style, political style, social style, every single aspect of it is an attempt to try and reverse course basically on the digital age and those who currently dominate it, I would say.
That's a welcome idea here at Tectonic. We should also say that County Highway, as you say, there is a digital edition, but if you subscribe, most people are going to get the physical edition, which is a traditional broadsheet newspaper in the postal mail. And across the top is emblazoned the tagline of County Highway, which is America's only newspaper.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't have anything coming up with that tagline. I'm sure it was David's idea, who's the mastermind behind the whole project. David Samuels, who's, you know, been my mentor for, makes me feel old, 2 decades now. But, you know, he and Walter Kern came up with it. But, you know, David is really the absolute editorial mastermind and creator of the whole project. And I don't know, I feel really lucky to be involved. I mean, I've been involved since the beginning, and I've actually proposed many things to them to try and expand my role. So we'll see if that eventually comes to pass.
Well, you do have something very prominent in the July-August 2025 issue mm-hmm. of County Highway. It's an essay called Soylent Screens, which has this subhead: the resource being maximized by digital technology is us.
Indeed. And pretty hard to argue with, I think, at least that part of it.
This is becoming a running joke on the show that I'll mention the movie Soylent Green, but I won't spoil it for listeners.
Right.
But say this has come up in a number of recent episodes, coincidentally. But say more about how we, the citizens, the users of technology, or perhaps I should say the people used by the technology, are the exploited resource.
Well, I mean, their whole business model, I think I use this quote from a friend of mine, Ian Marcus Coerben, where essentially he says, like, alienation and social enemy are essential to their business model, all right? I mean, like, and the most obvious example, of course, is how Twitter, you know, whether it's owned by Musk or the previous regime, everything is about divide, right? Everything is about trying to enrage people so that it keeps them, you know, constantly clicking, constantly doom scrolling. Okay, like, there's, you don't even necessarily have to point to mountains of evidence, but though there is evidence for how destructive this is, not just individually, but socially. And they could program it a different way. It's not like they have to do it this way. This is a choice that they're making, and they're committed to it. And you can see that it doesn't matter whether it's, quote, red controlled or blue controlled. This is the model. They want us to constantly be enraged at each other, constantly be fighting in terms of tribal bickering battles that are ultimately, in most cases, useless, as they're focused almost always on social, cultural issues that will never be resolved. Okay, they're unresolvable issues that date back to usually religious divides that go back, you know, 2 centuries, if not, we really want to talk 3 centuries or more. These things are unresolvable, and it's the background for everything that we're talking about. Hooray. What a wonderful advancement. What fantastic technological advancements we have achieved.
Well, what they would say is that they are optimizing for engagement in order to drive more ad impressions to support their advertising-based business model. But whether that's the primary or secondary or tertiary issue, something else that comes in the mix, of course, is that as people are being enraged and pitted against each other, we are thereby distracted from some of the larger forces that are exploiting us, which you write about later in this essay. Before we move on, I just wanted to say another item about that Ian Marcus Coerben quote, that loneliness is the point of these systems. Mm-hmm. I would give the example of Mark Zuckerberg's recent comments that if people are lonely, they can just spin up an AI personality bot to chat with.
it's comical, but it isn't, right? The dystopian nature of all this, right? I mean, there's recently been a lot written about how distorted people's perception of reality quickly becomes if they spend too much time chatting with an AI chatbot. And obviously, they don't see any problem with this. And I mean, there's so many unfathomably concerning elements about AI that it's difficult to really categorize them all and where to begin. But the main thing is that this technology, as I think we were discussing a little bit before we actually came on, is it's a choice to make it like this. They could choose to make it in another way. But what I'm getting at in this piece and other many other things that I've written in advancing my own radical middle philosophy is essentially that this is the choice that will always be made if it's done under liberal capitalism. Okay, this is how liberal capitalism will use this technology if we don't have a different philosophical and political economy approach, that this is an inevitable result.
Let's talk about this upcoming transition that you're writing about. You write in this Soylent Screens essay, quote, "As we embark on the next stage of the Industrial Revolution, it's clear Silicon Valley's goal is to isolate us from both the physical environment and each other as much as possible. They won't give up on the idea until we relinquish our resistance to wearing computers on our faces or putting computer chips inside our brains." Duncan, I really wish you were writing metaphorically there, but this is literally...
No, it's literal. That's what they want. It's pretty clear.
So what is it about the chips in the brains and computers on the face that is so important to Silicon Valley? We've talked generally about social media algorithms dividing people and enraging people, but this seems like a step even further. In what direction?
Well, they want all of our attention at all times, right? When people use the term attention economy, I think that's a pretty good term, right? Like, we don't talk enough, honestly, about the mass addiction crisis that smartphones have created. I wrote about this a couple years ago in a different piece. That's, honestly, I can't even remember the name of the essay, so I can't plug it. But essentially, that we live in an addiction crisis that's bigger than even, say, the opium wars. Okay, everyone, everywhere you go, is looking at their phones constantly, and it's not necessarily a choice at this point. It's addiction. You know what I mean? If you're not using your smartphone constantly, you're the person who's consciously making a different choice from the norm. And people would be aware of this, for instance, if everyone was, say, addicted to like a new kind of smoking tool or something, right? Like if everybody was going around and vaping per se, and obviously I know that vaping is a problem, an addiction problem, but it's obviously not at this scale, right? So if everyone literally was vaping at the same rate as people have smartphone use, you know, to the point where they're literally like not watching their own kids, they're not raising their own kids. I mean, all you have to do is go into a subway in New York and you can see how every single person at any moment in time, or maybe not every single person, but let's say like 98% of people are on their phone at all times. And the very disturbing thing you'll see in a New York subway is people who have their children who are, you know, less than 2 years old, smartphone plugged in hand. So the addiction begins not at quite in the womb, but as close as possible. Right. And this is an attention. Going back to your original question of computers on the face,
And chips in the brain.
Microchips in the brain. This is the logic of liberal capitalism applied to an attention economy. They will never be satisfied with enough profits from this. So if they have to put microchips in our brain to know what we're thinking so that they can sell us what we're thinking, not just like what appears on the screen and what our behavioral habits of what we type into the phone want to give back to us. Like literally you think about a lawnmower and then all of a sudden your eyeballs see lawnmower ads. Like that's the level of control of making us consume as much as possible as they want, you know, whether it's a computer on the face or a microchip in the head. That's the goal.
Yeah, you've described my experience perfectly. Every week I go to the station in Jersey City using the New York City subway and then the PATH train, which is the subway from Manhattan to New Jersey. And I've talked about this on the show before. Sitting on the subway car, it's like being in a zombie apocalypse movie. Looking left, everyone's on their phone. Looking right, everyone's on their phone. And once in a while, once in a blue moon, there'll be someone else reading a book, because I always bring a print book. And quite often our eyes will meet, and it's like, we're the only two humans left. Should we band together?
It is like that, right? I mean, and actually, every time you see somebody with a print book, you kind of, you do sort of have like an almost like a moment of recognition if you're the other person, like you said, that's straight out of a 60s film, you know, like Body Snatcher, an Invasion of the Body Snatchers or something, like, oh, we're actually not zombified. But how long before that's unheard of? I mean, I almost like don't know. I mean, obviously there's going to be a blowback. There's a small group of us, you know, to a certain extent, who are very aware of these things, but it's not that big.
It's not that big. And I should say, it's not just limited to the subway. Some people could say, well, the subway is a pretty benign place. All you're doing is waiting to get to your destination. So what's the harm? But I would point out that it's outside the subway as well. I just had this experience a day or two ago. I was walking in my neighborhood, and I just noticed everyone I passed was on a phone. There's someone walking his dog. He's on the phone. There's someone who is a contractor who's working on a job, who's sitting looking at his phone. There's someone on a bike, cycling down the avenue.
Oh, I see that all the time.
He's on his phone.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the parent with the stroller. The parent's on the phone, and if you look in the stroller, if the kid is old enough to hold a device in front of their face, they quite often have an addiction device, a surveillance device in front of their face as well. It does bring up this question of how far gone is our society when, you know, New York City used to be known as the city that never sleeps. It has such a great culture. It's vibrant in all of this. And it just, I feel often, am I the crazy one, or does it feel like the experience of being in an urban environment has totally been dimmed as everybody is walking, sitting, cycling, strolling, jogging, subwaying, always with a screen in their face?
Well, I think it hasn't just dimmed city life, it's dimmed rural life. And I'll give you an example. I mean, not that everything you said wasn't, you know, 100% correct. There's always been an alienating effect of city life. Okay. You know, like Richard Sennett used to talk about this, you know, how you can be in a crowd of people, and this is, you know, decades before smartphones, and it's inherently alienating because you're around, you know, thousands of people or hundreds of people or whatever, dozens of people on a subway, but you're not engaged with any of them, right? Like, so you're in a social environment, but you're alienated because you can't actually most often engage with people. But that's amplified now, right? So actually, let me give you the rural example of how it's actually still omnipresent to a certain extent in rural life. So I was living in a somewhat rural part of Florida, which I was originally excited to be in, until I walked around this neighborhood, which actually had a golf course in it. So you're like, okay, wow, not only is it rural, but it literally has a golf course like in the middle of the neighborhood. It was a very unusual situation. But whenever I'd walk around this area, all of the neighbors would literally be doing what's called sodcasting. I mentioned this in the piece, right? Where they're blasting their on their stupid smartphone speakers. Like, they didn't even have the wherewithal or the decency to like not do this, you know, in this semi-pristine rural area. And then, you know, the neighborhood had this like child's playground, and it had like basketball courts. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic. I can just walk down to the neighborhood and, you know, play a little bit of basketball. I'd go out there and the same thing. They'd bring their stupid Bluetooth speakers and listen to their crappy pop music, you know, in this rural area. Like, they had no appreciation for the fact that other people might not want to have the same experience as them. and the fact that like nobody is preventing this from happening. And this is what happens when you live in a society like ours that has very thin social ties, which is the essence of liberalism in the classical sense of being tied to the individual. Okay, everything in liberal political economy is about the individual, right? You have rights that are experienced individually, right? Your whole experience is centered around the individual. Well, when you create a society like this and you empower everyone to have an individual experience constantly, things start to break down and you no longer actually have practically any social, at least healthy social experience. As you said, you're in the biggest city in the world or in the country. And yet everyone is constantly attempting to have an individual experience at all times, to the point where their eyes are literally glued to this addictive device that's going to provide them with the simulacra of individual experience.
And another aspect that you touch on in this essay that feeds into this process is what becomes the compulsory nature of the usage of these devices. The iPhone was this interesting device from Apple that a few people were using. And then over several years, it became an aspirational device. Some people were still using a BlackBerry or a flip phone, but you know, maybe someday I'll get one of those iPhones I'm hearing so much about. Today, whether you use the Apple surveillance phone or the Google surveillance phone, It's becoming all but compulsory. If you want to enter sports stadiums,
even travel. Like to travel to the UK, which I did last month, the main way that they offer this thing that they now make you fill out to go to the UK was through the smartphone. Like, yes, you could technically fill it out on a browser or something, but the main way they wanted you to do it was on a smartphone. It would have taken like literally like four times as much time.
Right. And you touch on this in your Soylent Screen's essay in the context of workers. As bad as it is for citizens or travelers who are trying to get from point A to point B, workers really are a captive audience to whatever technology the boss layers into the office environment. A lot of workers are now under constant surveillance. Here's what you write. The real aim is total behavioral monitoring and compliance with corporate profiteering mandates. Soon, the consent forms will not be optional, not if you want to keep the job, at least. Eventually, our every keystroke will be monitored and every eye glance and body position analyzed for efficiency. That suggests an even more dystopian future for workers.
I think that's one of the most terrifying aspects. I mean, they're added to a very long list of AI is the use of camera technology to trace body movements and position, behavioral monitoring and the like, which I think is not too far down the line in terms of implementation. If you think about this use for employees where they can track, they'll be able to track everything, not just body position, but facial expressions and things like this. Imagine what they're going to do with this. I mean, they're already on it. There are companies that are already working on this. I don't remember their names off the top of my head, but they're in part because there's so many. Like if you start poking around, it's quite a few. And so I imagine there'll be a lot of resistance to it initially, but you can see a world where they'll, especially in states where there aren't great labor laws, which is, you know, in the U.S., we have the worst labor laws in terms of protections for workers on the job, in terms of the wealthy industrialized world that is, at least. You can imagine a world where companies will just have cameras everywhere, you know, whether it's on your iPhone tracking you and there's an app that you have to agree to use, or it's on your desktop, especially if you're a remote worker, that you'll have to agree to use. You'll have to agree to every single thing, as I mentioned, keystroke being monitored, right? And then through AI, they can analyze all these things of whether or not you're working, quote, hard enough or efficiently enough. And you already see that AI is firing people. They literally don't even have human people actually creating dismissal letters, or even necessarily, I believe in certain cases, reviewing the data. They're just going by what the AI says, like, are you efficient enough? This should be one of the major, most concerning elements that we talk about when we talk about the implementation of AI. I think this is way more concerning than the concept that, like, you're going to get hyper-intelligent robots soon that take people's job. I mean, that is really far down the line. I mean, that's so much further. Think of, like, self-driving cars, for instance. Self-driving cars, we've been told for 10 years are right around the corner. Oh, self-driving cars right around the corner. Self-driving cars right around the corner. Okay, that's been happening for 10 years. I mean, eventually they'll get here, but most of it has been hype. The roboticized stuff, that's hype, okay? The concept that, like, even AI will take your white-collar job, some of that is genuine concern, but most of that is hype to try and get investment. The stuff that I'm talking about is not hype. They are not far away with that stuff. And that would create so much human misery, it's hard to really overestimate it.
Yeah, there's a writer, and I'm blanking on his name, but he had this clever concept a couple of years ago, and I'll just paraphrase. It went something like this. The tech bros are warning of a technological force that is going to take over and enslave humanity and have all sorts of negative long-term effects. And so we have to guard against it now. And the tech bros claim that it's AI. But the reality is that force is already here, and it's the growth at any cost tech corporation.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we don't need a super intelligent AI that is, I don't know, maximizing paperclips and turning the world's industry into its own plaything, because we already have tech billionaires who are doing the same thing with our economy and recently in the U.S. government.
Well, I mean, and that's been the case for a long time. I mean, that's kind of inherent to the structure of our system, but the technology allows them a reach that they've never had before. Okay, like that's the part that is somewhat new. Okay, so we're living essentially through a second Gilded Age. But what it concerns me the most about the time that we live in is, if you look back at the first Gilded Age, you had a very organized, virulent labor movement that was really willing to pay a very dear price. I mean, there was just incredible violence, especially in the United States, against people trying to organize, but they kept with it. Okay, this was a massive movement that paid serious human costs, time costs, effort costs to organize itself. And then that, once it actually had any kind of sympathetic actor in the U.S. government, which came, you know, with Franklin Roosevelt, then it started to see real results. But it had been building for essentially about 45 to 50 years prior to that. Okay, here's the problem: is we don't have that.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We're halfway through my interview with Duncan Mensch, author of the new essay in County Highway called Soylent Screens, with the subhead, "The Resource Being Maximized by Digital Technology is Us." And I think you get a sense of Duncan's and my shared complaints. In the second half of the interview, we're going to move forward into what I promise at the top of the show is a more hopeful vision for the future called producerism. Let's go ahead and listen to the second half of my interview with Duncan Mensch here on Tectonic. You bring up an important aspect of this transition, which is that the roots of some of these ideas go way back. I was pleased to see that in your essay, you named one of my favorite authors, Jacques Ellul, this French philosopher and writer, who was writing about the dangers of, as he called it, the technological society back in the 1960s. So we're talking 60 years ago. And as you write, starting in the early 1960s, Ellul pointed out that anything not abiding by the imperatives of technological efficiency has become next to impossible to sustain, much less implement anew. Basically, what Ellul is saying there is there's a certain technological agenda, and you'd better get on board, and you'd better fit in and comply. And any kind of idea, let alone initiative, outside the technological agenda is just cast aside. And that was back in the 60s. And here we are in 2025 having this conversation that even the simple act of taking a walk through a park, if you don't have your eyes glued to an addictive handheld device, you're the weird one.
But you also can't escape it. That's one of the things I point out, is you also can't genuinely escape it. So every aspect of our attention is being sapped from us, in part because of the ubiquity of it all, right? Going back to the fact that, like, you could take, think if you go back 100 years ago, you could have walked through Central Park. You're not going to hear anybody's speaker, anybody's individual music, right? You're going to have a nice, peace, quiet experience, right? Same thing if you go on a hike, except now you can't. Like, I mean, I was on a hike in Arizona, okay, on a freaking mountain, and I couldn't escape all the idiots with their smartphone speakers. Like, I'm on a mountain, okay? Like, so you literally, like, there's no escaping this part of the experience. Through the ubiquity of the technology, you now are, we're stuck inside of it, okay? Which is part of what makes you, so then the only way to genuinely escape it is to put in some kind of, like, noise canceling, whether it's earbuds or headphones, right? And so then you're part of it.
Well, maybe we could spend a few minutes, Duncan, talking about a solution that you have in mind that you've written about a number of times.
Yeah.
This is an idea that you call producerism. This is not an idea that you have invented. You write that this is an idea that's been bouncing around for a long time. It's never come to the fore, but now is the moment.
Well, that's what I would argue. Yeah. I mean, I hope I'm right about this because, okay, so producerism is a concept that really was never developed into, like, a full-scale ideology or a political economy, which is essentially what I'm kind of treating as my life's work, you know, having taught political ideologies courses for more than 10 years. And then I wrote a master's thesis under the supervision of one of the world's greatest radicals on basically heterodox proposals for political economy. So all this kind of came together for me because as I taught classes on political ideologies, I taught everything from, you know, the history of liberalism, conservatism, socialism, fascism, and everything in between. As I would teach these courses, it just occurred to me that none of these things are actually capable of solving our problems. And so I kind of started looking back and tried to figure out, well, then people must have had ideas about these things that we haven't necessarily recognized. And I would say that the one with the most promise is producerism. And it was really just kind of a latent ideology, mostly advanced, or actually I wouldn't even call it an ideology. It was more just kind of like a disposition where people wanted to put workers and those who produce wealth rather than possess wealth or manage wealth at the forefront of everything. And that's what I would argue is the thing that we must do. We must choose how we value things. And one of the biggest problems, for instance, with Marx, which I write about in this Soylent Screen pieces, and I'll write about more in the future, is that Marx thought he could scientifically prove what created economic value. That's what he was trying to do. Most people don't understand at all what he's actually trying to do in his most famous work, Das Kapital, which you ever pick up is one of the most boring books you'll ever read. I mean, it's got all these ridiculous graphs and mathematical attempts to, you know, add up these weird 19th century, I'm sure they were pertinent for the time, formulas. But he's essentially, what he's trying to do in that book is he's trying to take the prices that exist in the marketplace and he's trying to prove that you can trace back their value to labor. But that's a ridiculous way of looking at it because that's not going to work because the prices that are in the marketplace are a reflection of our current value system, what people, economists call instrumental value, which grows out of liberal economic theory. The idea that you can look at, say, like a chair in the marketplace and say, oh, well, okay, its value may change based on the day or the time or who sat in it. So, you know, if Napoleon sat in this chair, oh, all of a sudden that chair is worth dramatically more. We just accept this as normal, but that's actually not normal and it's actually not consistent, right? What Marx didn't except which I'm arguing is a producerist approach, is the approach that we have to choose what we value. And we'll never escape that. And if we choose to value work, then everything else sort of unravels from that choice. Okay. And there are many other things with producerism also, but producerism is something that puts work, human work, at the center of an economic system. And if you think about it, that may seem like a very reductionist way of looking at things, but it's actually not. It changes practically everything once you do that. Because the problem with Marxism was that Marx thought he could create an efficient system. Sound familiar? He thought that the most important thing was to create this hyper-efficient economy so we could escape work. He's using the same logic of liberal economy. We need to do the reverse. We need to accept that work will always be inevitable and embrace it and say that work is how we actually create meaning in our lives, but insist that we're paid what we're worth and not give so much power to those who, quote, manage the wealth rather than those who produce the wealth. And there's many other things that are essentially totally anathema to the way we think about our current economy. But what I would argue is that heterodox nature of producerism is exactly what we need. We need to completely rethink how we organize every aspect of what we're doing.
A few years ago, you wrote a piece called A Producerist Manifesto, and you republished that on your blog recently. I'll put a link to A Producerist Manifesto on the playlist. In this manifesto of producerism, you have several bullet points of what producerism means, how you define it. And one that stuck out to me is number 11, encourage, sponsor, and rigorously develop the use of analog technologies to replace digital technologies whenever and wherever possible. There are inherent natural reasons why a vinyl record sounds warm, alive, and present, whereas even a lossless digital audio file sounds distant, stale, and forced. There's something inherently displeasing and unhealthy and also addictive to the human brain about digital technologies. Our brains need to be permitted to pause and contemplate. Filling them with meaningless chatter and manipulation undermines a healthy democratic culture. So here you're singing the praises of analog technology, and presumably that fits into valuing human non-digital work that would produce such things.
Yeah, and so I've kind of, when my version of producerism, I've taken a lot of different inspirations. So a lot of people say, well, who are the big producers to look towards? Like, there really aren't, okay? So I'm taking a hodgepodge of different ideas in this, but this push towards more analog technology, a lot of people will kind of push back at me and say, funny enough, they'll use the logic that I'm going against. They'll say, well, it's totally inefficient. I'm like, yes, that's the point, is that it's inefficient. Okay, yes, a vinyl record is inefficient, but if you're an audiophile, you won't encounter too many audiophiles who actually prefer a quote lossless file to at least as long as it's a clean record that doesn't have a bunch of scratches or doesn't have imperfections, that doesn't have dust on it. A vinyl record sounds alive. It sounds real, okay? And it's the same thing with reading a physical book. There's a different experience to reading a physical book versus reading on the screen. And I would go back and forth to this with my students where I would say, look, I'm going to highly encourage you to not buy our textbooks online. In the sense of like, and experience them in an online way, whether it's on an iPad or
don't read them on a screen.
Or don't read them on a screen, okay? And there's volumes of research being done on this that's gone on for at least 10 years or more, that people's ability to remember a text, and I found this very distinctly in my own research, anything that I read on my Kindle for an academic purpose, I had to go out and rebuy physical books because I couldn't remember them. Not to mention, I literally could not figure out all of the key things and passages because I couldn't remember where they were. You know, even if I highlighted them, it didn't work. And there's been studies about this where, for instance, there's this phenomenon, if you read physical books, where you'll remember something in the book, and then you'll go back to the book. And even if you didn't mark the page, you'll have remarkably good accuracy and kind of just like almost magically flipping to the page of where it was, because your brain is mapping it as a physical object and it's associating the knowledge with a physical place. Whereas if you're reading on a screen, that doesn't happen. And the same phenomenon, there's tons of studies about this. I can't cite them because, you know, I don't care to put them to memory, but you can look them up, that writing notes by hand has a very different effect than writing notes on your laptop or on your smartphone. And I would go back and forth with this when I taught classes, like, no, I don't want you taking notes by laptop unless you can, you know, I had a kid who had his hands blown off. Okay, you can take notes for sure by a computer device. Everybody else, you don't have an excuse, okay? Unless you have a real reason, you should be taking notes by hand, because we know that this translates to actual memory and knowledge. And the same kind of thing happens with practically everything. Now, that doesn't mean that in an ideal economic setting, there isn't a lot of really appropriate uses for digital technology. There definitely are, and there should be. But we should try to find analog solutions where we can, because it changes our experience in a positive way.
Let's talk about some of those authors who you've borrowed from. We mentioned Jacques Ellul before.
He's fantastic. I'm not a scholar of his, but everything about him is pretty amazing.
The Technological Society is the book that really lays out his philosophy. Lewis Mumford is another author I know you like and I like as well. His book, Technics and Civilization, that also is a book that is praising the idea of small producers in opposition to what he calls the mega machine, which we're certainly facing today. And then I wanted to ask you, is Ivan Illich in your pantheon of authors who you've...
I'm not familiar with his stuff. I'll have to put it on my list. And I would see, this is the thing, is I would argue that there's a whole constellation of authors that kind of exist in this almost producerist space, but they're not thought of that way. And so that's sort of what I'm trying to do, is trying to work from their notes to turn this into coherent philosophy. Okay. So that would be my strength, is trying to make these connections between all these things and to try and turn it into a coherent system of economic and political thought, because that has never happened. Well, I mean, for instance, Ellul is a brilliant critic, right? Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Mumford also, but there's not a coherent economic project there. And so the goal is to turn it into a coherent economic project and show people that we could live in a different way. Because what I would argue is one of the biggest problems that we have is everything is just criticism. And okay, I know that there's an irony there that my title at my tablet is Social Critic at Large. I get that that's ironic. I get that. Okay. But part of the reason why I wrote about producerism is directly, I want to show people that we can't just criticize, that we have to have the guts to actually put our flag somewhere and say that the world could operate differently and try to figure out how it could. Because if we don't do that, if we don't start having the guts to say the world could operate in a different way and here's how it could, we're going to be subsumed by some pretty dark, frankly, okay? Like, and we're already being subsumed. We just talked about it. I mean, the whole fact that we go into public spaces and nobody can have attention. Nobody can be present with other people. We're already living through a digital dystopia, okay? That's a phrase I actually used that the editors cut, but I want to use it more. We're living through the digital dystopia. It's already with us, and it's going to get more advanced.
It's true, and we need more ideas out there for what we can do next.
But we have to have the guts to do that, is what I would argue. And the thing is, you have to have when I wrote the original Producers Manifesto, it was funny because everybody seized on this one thing like that they thought was just like ridiculous. And what was really funny to me about it was the one thing that has actually been tried and worked. And it was this concept of creating an alternative wage system centered around hourly work, where we would have an alternative wage system where people are paid based off of labor hours inputted. Okay. And everyone's like, oh, that's ridiculous. That would never work. Well, the funny thing is it actually has worked. There's this thing called the Ithaca Hour that I don't know if it exists anymore, but people have tried this in different spaces. And I would argue you can't have an entire monetary system constructed around this. Although with AI, you could definitely calculate education inputs and base that on the eventual wage of the person and have a pretty remarkably accurate system. But even if it functions as an alternative monetary system to our existing system, that would change a lot. Like if you allowed people to be paid by labor hours in addition to or part of their pay, it would change all kinds of things. And so when I got criticism based off of this, I don't know if it's just my personality. I was like, okay, well, then we'll alter it slightly. I don't know if it's just my makeup, but I don't care if people point out flaws in my reasoning because then I'll just improve them. Right? Like that's the attitude we have to have. We'll figure it out. We'll make it better. I don't know everything. You don't know everything. Nobody knows everything. Like that's not, I'm not a God. You're not a God. Marx wasn't a God. Adam Smith wasn't a God. Nobody's figured everything out. Like we can't have that attitude.
As you write, with AI poised to add a new level of chaos to our world, producerism's moment has arrived, and you're giving us a starting point to debate and, as you say, have the guts to put something together. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Duncan, to walk us through the problems that we're all facing and to put forward your proposed solution. Duncan Mensch, thanks so much for being on Tectonic.
Hey, it's been awesome. Thank you.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 10 or so minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with writer Duncan Mensch, who's got a piece out in County Highway, this newspaper that's being sent out to people all over. The piece is called Soylent Screens. The resource being maximized by digital technology is us. And I think you heard in Duncan's passionate criticism of technology in society today, and also his enthusiasm for producerism, that he's got a lot of ideas, very provocative person, and I'm so happy he was on the show. If you're interested in links to Duncan's work that we talked about during the interview or some of the other resources that came up, go to the playlist for today's show. You can find it at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and just click the playlist link for the Duncan Mensch episode. You'll see it right there. I'll notice a couple. Mention a couple of things. One is that the Ithaca Hours program that Duncan brought up, I looked it up, and Ithaca Hours was an existing program in Ithaca, New York for a number of years. It's no longer in use, but there is a Wikipedia page on the playlist that you can read up on what happened with that program. And one of the nice things about the Ithaca Hours project is that it inspired other cities to try their own alternative currencies. And so you can read up on those other cities that have tried that idea. Another thing is that I said during the interview that there was a writer whose name I couldn't think of that talked about the danger of AI really being embodied by the technology corporations. That writer is named Charlie Strauss, or Charles Strauss. He's a sci-fi author. I just couldn't think of his name during the interview, but of course, afterwards, it came to me. So I have put on the playlist a link to an old essay by a past Tectonic guest, friend of the show, Cory Doctorow, who wrote this piece back in December of 2017. And Dr. O was summarizing a talk that Charlie Strauss had given, advancing that basic idea. And I'll just read a quote from the Dr. O piece. Corey writes, "Strauss is very interested in what it means that today's tech billionaires are terrified of being slaughtered by psychotic runaway AIs. Like sci-fi author Ted Chiang and me, Strauss thinks that corporations are slow AIs that show what happens when we build machines designed to optimize for one kind of growth above all moral or ethical considerations, and that these captains of industry are projecting their fears of the businesses they nominally command onto the computers around them." And I would just add, on top of that Dr. O quote, that those tech billionaires are not just projecting their fears onto the computers. They are doing that, but they're also projecting their fears onto society at large, as so much of society in the ensuing, 7+ years since that column, has now been organized around the idea of investing in AI and somehow trying to guard against runaway psychotic Terminator scenarios, which are not going to happen. And we're still facing all of these other risks and harms from AI, again, as embodied by these tech corporations. So we need more thinking like Duncan Mensch's, like Charlie Strauss's, like Cory Doctorow's, to try to remind us where the harms actually are, and so that we don't get distracted. As Duncan said at the beginning of the interview, so much of these algorithms are tuned to get us distracted from the real issues and instead to fight each other, to create division, to inflame tensions, and in some cases, in some documented cases, actual violence. And that makes money for the companies, but it does nothing for society. So I'm hoping that an interview like this and the readings that I'm pointing to on the playlist will give you some food for thought and something that you can talk with your friends and colleagues with and say, you know what, we should get off of these big tech algorithms, and that there are alternatives. There are alternatives. There are alternative platforms I've talked about on past shows. And as we hear from Duncan Mensch, there are alternative ideas that we can look into. Speaking of those other things that you can read, I mentioned some books, and I just wanted to go over the titles and authors. If you'd like a reading list, you remember those old Charlie Brown specials when he shows up at the end of the episode? If you'd like to learn more, go to your public library. And so that's the position I'm taking here. Go to your public library, friends, and see if you can check out the following books. The first one is the book that we opened, or I mentioned in the interview that Duncan mentioned in his essay. It's called The Technological Society. It's by Jacques Ellul. As far as I know, it's still in print 60 years after it came out in English, and that is very well worth your time if you'd like to read about the inexorable spread of technology taking over everything. Ellul really, really called it. The second one I recommend is by Lewis Mumford. It's called Technics and Civilization. And in that book, Mumford is going over his own history of technology and how it has affected society, starting with the clock. And once you read that, you will never look at clocks quite the same. I recommend that book by Lewis Mumford. Of course, he wrote a lot more about technology, but that's a good one to start with, Technics and Civilization. And finally, I'd recommend the book Tools for Conviviality by Ivan Illich. Illich is really suggesting new ways for us to think about technology, develop technology, and invest in technology that would create good outcomes for society, not the horrible dystopian outcomes that the tech billionaires are foisting on us every day today. And I do have one other piece of homework for you in addition to those three books. I want you to do the following. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Please stay tuned for my buddy, Dave Mandel, who's got a handle on It's Complicated, It's a Prog Rock Show. He's coming right up. And for our outro today, I came across, thanks to my brother Daniel Blumen, a perfectly relevant song. It's called The Screens of Our Lives, and it's by Posthuman. I think you're really gonna appreciate it, because here we are talking about Soylent Screens. So enjoy it, friends, and have a great week. I'll see you next time.
And good evening. Welcome to another installment of It's Complicated, 60 minutes of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here bringing this show to you every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you for joining me. Hope your Monday has been great so far. I hope it gets even greater over the next hour or so. We're going to start tonight's show with something. I don't have anything really clever to say about these folks. This is a Swedish group, and they have a flute player. Any band with a flute is all right by me. So this is going to be something from the group Agusa, A-G-U-S-A, again from Sweden. You're going to hear a track from a release called Prima Materia, released a couple of years ago.